With that, I'm delighted to introduce Sir David Logan. David had a very distinguished career in the British Diplomatic Service and was, amongst many other posts, the ambassador, Arab ambassador, crucial role he played, as I was able to witness, here in Ankara for a period, a great Turkey-file. He subsequently led the Institute for Advanced European Studies at the University of Birmingham, and as well as other posts he's got in the private sector, he's chairman of the British Institute in Ankara. David.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jack. I went to my betting shop a couple of weeks ago to ask whether they'd give me odds on the Turkish election result. And they said, no, they did that in 2007 and lost a lot of money. And I said, well, you know, I really needed to know do a bit of work on this. And I was sorry about that because I was speaking here at the Global Strategy Forum on the 14th of June. And they said, the 14th of June, forget it, you don't need to do anything. So I said, why? And they said, it's the first day of Ascot, there'll be no one there. So it's really good that so many of you forewent Ascot. Well, this, of course, was never an election about who was going to win, because the AKP were always going to do that. It was an election about numbers. Would the AKP majority be big enough for them to be able to change the constitution unilaterally? Or failing that, would it be big enough for them to be able to put constitutional proposals to a referendum without actually consulting other parties in the Majlis? And what about the CHP, which is, the traditional home of the secularist establishment? It's got new leadership. Under that new leadership, would it be able to get about the sort of base 20%, hardcore 20%, which is what it's getting at the moment, and offer a more relevant socially contemporary agenda and look like a modern democratic opposition party which would seriously challenge AKP populism? And what about the southeast of Turkey? There have been a lot of recent outrages by the PKK. Would that help the nationalist MHP cross the 10% barrier, which 10% of the vote barrier, which under the Turkish constitution you have to be able to do to get representation in parliament? And what about the Kurds? Will they support the explicitly Kurdish BDP? Or had the government, the AKP done enough to persuade them that the policies which had made the AKP government overwhelmingly successful in the rest of the country apply to them as well? So those, I think, were the questions, and in brief, here are the answers. The AKP got more than 50% of the vote. That's overwhelming support, and it's overwhelming support which reflects an electoral demography which essentially guarantees AKP success on a very big scale in virtually any circumstance. However, it has fewer seats than it had in the last parliament, and it didn't win enough seats to be able to change the constitution without some cooperation from other parties. The CHP did better. It won 24 more seats than it did in 2007, so it reflected a new political relevance by its new leadership. But it's a modest advance. Its supporters won't be satisfied, and you have to wonder whether there'll be more unrest within the party of the sort which led to the election of its new chairman, Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu. The MHP squeaked into Parliament with 13% of the vote and 56 seats. That's 15 fewer than it had in 2007, but enough to ensure that extreme nationalism will actually be represented in Parliament and not just on the street, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. But it was a decline of the vote, and you have to ask yourself whether in contemporary Turkey a nationalism, an exclusively nationalist pact of the sort on which the MHP depends, is actually relevant. And I think the big result was that the Kurdish BDP gained ground from the AKP in the southeast. It returned 36 deputies. For complicated Turkish electoral reasons, they all stood as independents, but they are BDP representatives. Six of them are in jail. Two of the representatives were elected in Istanbul, and I think that's a very important and interesting development. So that's a result in the southeast, primarily, which reflects disillusion there with the government's failure to make good on its promise of a Kurdish opening. And so, you know, the big question is now, how will the PDP and the AKP government deal with each other against the background of that real success? So that's the result. What does it mean? What does it mean for Turkey? What does it mean for the Middle East, Turkey's neighbourhood? What does it mean for us? As far as Turkey is concerned, I've got two worries. The first is the economy. As most of you know, I'm sure, it's been growing at a very high rate in the region recently of 9% per annum. That has been largely driven by domestic demand. And although the central bank has acted very prudently, I think, in trying to deal with conditions which have been pumped up by pre-election government policies, it hasn't been able to restrict domestic credit growth. Inflation has just started to rise again. I don't think that imports will slow down, and I don't think that oil prices are going to go down. So although the very recent figures on the current account deficit show a slight improvement, that remains serious, and it is a fact that I think the economy is overheating. So the question now is whether Prime Minister Erdogan, with the election won, will feel able to tighten tighten his economic belt and do that sufficiently severely to match what the actual demands of the situation are. I mean, will the Turkish economic landing be hard or soft? And that's an important question, without for a moment wishing to detract from the very great success of the Turkish economy in the last few years since the banking reforms undertaken in 2001. Okay, and then secondly, politics. I think probably not in this audience, but there's a sort of uneducated bit of foreign oversimplification about the AKP government, which is that it has an agenda to Islamize the country. It's true that the majority of Turks are devout and that the majority of Turks are conservative. And it's true that their stake in the country's governance, which since 2001 has been represented by the AKP, has steadily become more influential to the dismay of the old secularist establishment. So the AKP both reflects their devout and conservative attitudes. It also exploits these to ensure its political dominance. But that, I don't think any of that means Islamism in the sense in which, as I say, lazy and somewhat ignorant Western commentators tend to think. They make an elision between Islamism and the return of the Sharia, which is simply nonsense. I think what's not so good is that the AKP, admittedly like past Turkish governments, has become steadily more, I think the word is clientelist, in the way it conducts government. AKP supporters assume positions of influence. Companies run by AK sympathisers get big government contracts. As I said, this happened in the past too, but the stakes now are much bigger because the Turkish economy is so successful. And I think that this is a fact which has reinforced the polarisation, the already serious polarisation of Turkish society. The Turkish political process is one where the government has appeared increasingly intolerant of opposition and criticism, and increasingly focused on narrow political advantage. If you looked at the BBC this morning, you will see something relevant on freedom of expression in Turkey today, with the arrest by Turkish police of 32 members of the hacker collective known as Anonymous. And this relates probably to the intention of the Turkish government to introduce a filter system for access to the internet in August. Right, so the Prime Minister wants to amend the constitution, and constitutional amendment is certainly needed. But his apparent desire for a presidential system instead of the existing system is controversial. Reform must be based on full consultation, because Turkey needs a modern liberal constitution based on the widest popular possible consent. It needs political tolerance and outreach if it is developed into a true democracy, and that's the vital challenge for the new AKP administration. My chairman says I haven't got time to talk about the implications for the Middle East or for Europe, but I'll
just a minute.
Just 1 minute. 1 minute. Okay. Well, I mean, on the Middle East, I want to say one thing, which I hope the ambassador would agree with. It is this: the foreign minister's zero problems with neighbours policy has clearly been thrown into disarray because Turkey's new relationships with her Arab neighbours was established with governments, and those governments have now lost credibility. But I don't think that Turkey is any different from the rest of us in this respect. Turkey's new relationships with her Arab neighbours go deeper than the government level, and I believe that Turkey is capable of managing the transition and of resuming her regional role with successor administrations. So, as I say, I think the commonplace that the current foreign policy is in disarray because the people Minister Davutoğlu was dealing with aren't around anymore is misguided. Turkey's in the same position as the rest of us. We're all having to start again, and Turkey is as well or better placed to do that than anyone else. Just final 2 points, if I may. One is about Europe. I mean, there's a simplistic bit of dualism which goes on, again, in this country. People say she's intensifying her relations with the Middle East, ergo she's turning away from Europe. I think that's nonsense. Anyone who can recall Turkey's cool relations with her neighbours in the last century is bound to conclude that actually what Foreign Minister Davutoğlu has embarked upon is simply a quest for normality. But I do think that the loss of momentum in the EU-Turkey relationship is concerning. I mean, the EU soft power was responsible for major reform in Turkey. That's now been lost. The Europeans have turned inwards because they're absorbed by the economic crisis facing the Eurozone. And many Turks make very oversimplistic comparisons between the Turkish and European growth rates and conclude that Turkey will be better off on its own. Both are mistaken. Turkish economic and political development will be best assured by revitalization of the accession process, and Europe too will be strengthened, because what matters for Europe is what Turkey has to offer in terms of political and security reach, regional stability, demography and diversity. And that's really all I want to say, except once again to say the challenge for the Prime Minister is one which is manageable, because the election result is one which to some extent is something of a wake-up call. Both he and the opposition parties need to reach out to bridge the appalling political divide which exists in Turkey. And the way that these results have panned out, I think, should give pause for thought among the AKP leadership, and I hope will enable them to reach out, as I say. The other parties, too, need to reach out. There's deep divisions and deep mutual recrimination which needs to be overcome if Turkey is to succeed as all her friends, and I know many of you here are Turkey's friends, will succeed as we want them to do. Thank you very much.
David, thank you very much indeed, and my apologies to all the speakers for the fact that I've got to hold to time, but the value of these meetings is that they last an hour, and all of us who are not speaking learn a huge amount from them. Some of us who are speaking learn a lot too. The next and the other speakers are certainly will be invited to speak for 5 minutes. The next speaker I'm very pleased to introduce is Baroness Emma Nicholson. Emma had a long and also distinguished career in the House of Commons and more recently in the House of Lords, as well as in the European Parliament. She's very active in many international organisations and is co-founder of the AMAR UNESCO Standing Conference to promote better understanding between European and Islamic civilizations, and knows the wider Middle East, Eastern Europe, very well. Emma, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Sorry about that. Jack, thank you very much for that kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very honoured to be here and very privileged. I've been a very early supporter, let me lay out my table plan immediately, a very early supporter indeed of Turkey's entrance into the European Union. So if I could be focusing my comments for a few moments on that important issue, I would be grateful if you would give me that time. From my perspective, the European Union will gain massively from Turkey's membership, and I've done all I can in the European Parliament in terms of votes, in terms of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and in terms of plenary sessions to push forward all the possible opportunities for Turkey to achieve that goal. Of course, I hesitate to say achieve that goal, because if Turkey doesn't want it, that's a different point of view. But from my perspective, as a parliamentarian from the United Kingdom, witnessing throughout my life Turkey's wonderful membership of NATO, her huge foreign policy influence in the region, her growing ties, very, very constructive indeed, with so many nations with which the EU, and particularly the UK and our allies, the USA, need those ties, I can see no better way forward for all of us than Turkey's membership of the European Union. So, the election, how does that impact upon that? I believe strongly that it's a very positive step forward, because Prime Minister Erdogan now, of necessity, will have to pull together in different ways, more as of a coalition to reform the constitution than perhaps he had previously suspected he would have to do had he had a clear majority. I think a two-third majority in this instance would have authorised him from the electorate to go straight ahead. So much more negotiation will have to happen. And certainly in my experience in the European Parliament, and temporarily as a member of the European Commission once or twice, negotiation is the name of the game. In a recent visit to Turkey, where I was fortunate to accompany Lord Anderson, and we were there with a number of other colleagues from the IPU British delegation, all of the discussion seemed to me, apart from the celebration of Turkey having Istanbul as the capital of culture, a very right and proper designation, apart from that, almost everything revolved around the possibilities of EU membership, good, bad, indifferent, wishful, against, and all the rest of it. I would add here that the very narrowness of our IPU delegation did reflect a rather poor thinking from the British perspective, in that we never once met the EU delegation itself. It was a very bizarre thing indeed, and that I put forward to the IPU should be altered immediately. Of course, the statement by the Minister for EU Affairs and the current chief negotiator on the establishment of the Ministry of European Union Affairs on Sunday was a very positive thing indeed. I quote, "Our government's decision to transform the decade-old Secretariat General for the European Union Affairs into a fully-fledged ministry, which will continue reporting directly to the Prime Minister, is a significant message to the European Union that Turkey keeps up the impetus in its determined drive towards EU membership, despite all political obstacles on its negotiation process. This move is also a clear response to the allegations that Turkey's foreign policy axis has shifted. After Sunday's elections, we are determined to push forward with the EU process through reforms on all areas that would upgrade individual liberties and improve the living standards of our citizens." Well, what a splendid statement, and how very clear that that's where the majority of Turks would like Turkey to progress. Of course, the minister mentioned political obstacles. I know that feeling. We had some political obstacles with the EU bill in the House of Lords last night. Indeed, alas, as some colleagues in this room would endorse very strongly, we lost one vote. Highly, highly annoying. We're looking to the Commons to try to reverse that process, and I think some colleagues here will help on that front. But looking particularly at two or three key points, the Cyprus problem, the political problem of Cyprus. Could I suggest most delicately that the window of opportunity is now, because as soon as Cyprus starts focusing on the EU presidency in 2012, it is inevitable that she will have to focus on that. She's a very small country. The EU presidency, despite the different councils that have been made out of almost nothing, so we have a number of different EU presidents from different angles, nonetheless, the EU presidency for a nation state, a member state, is a very powerful attraction, and it will demand all their energy before and after. So I would suggest that perhaps the window of opportunity after this election is absolutely now, and of course that the solution is available. It's a question of respecting each other's points of view and finding and implementing that solution. Might it be possible, for example, for the Turkish Cypriots themselves to be allowed a louder voice and perhaps be seen as a little bit more independent in finding an answer? Recently, I was visiting Armenia, and here I see there is most definite progress with the neighbourhood policy, the wider neighbourhood policy of the EU, and the potential bringing of Turkey into the EU coming together. I must admit that I'm not a sculptor, but I was only too delighted to see that Mr. Erdogan had that horrible sculpture demolished that was still being on the exact border of Turkey and Armenia and was unbelievably repugnant. A huge, monstrous edifice, supposedly of two hands. Nonetheless, the impetus behind that of the two hands was also a possible one. And if you could add that the upgrading of civil liberties will be of vital importance, including freedom to worship. And of course that means access to religions that are not Islam, such as Christianity, but does it not also mean this very, very difficult problem of the veil that so many Muslim sisters wish to wear? So not easy, but I do believe the opportunity is now, and I'm looking forward immensely to this government, this new government, moving further forward with the EU integration than has happened before. Thank you.
Like as it transpires, all members of this panel, our next speaker, Mehmet Ercu, has had a stellar career. He's currently Director for International Government Affairs at the BG Group, which some of us remember better as British Gas, but we're never allowed to mention the British word these days, because it is international remit, and it doesn't pipe gas into our homes anymore. He served in the Turkish Diplomatic Service and as head of the Global Forum for the OECD, and the IEA, Principal Administrator for Asia Pacific. He's written, as many of you all know, dozens of books, hundreds of articles. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to build on what David and Emma said, and not much left, actually, to say. A couple of points, perhaps, in the beginning. One, we have to understand that this was a very important election, giving a resounding victory for Prime Minister Erdogan, and also moral authority to forge his vision of Turkey. And the question now is how he intends to use this moral authority. This was the first non-early election in the past 34 years of Turkish history. And also, AKP also was the first party in the last 50 years to win three consecutive elections. And so there was also a voter turnaround of about 84%. This is record in European political scene as well. And Erdogan, after his election victory, as he happens to do it every time, he gave a balcony speech. In his balcony speech, he underlined his priorities for the period ahead. The first thing he said, actually, was he asked for forgiveness for the hearts that he broke before and during the election. And he had a lot of ground to cover on this in this way, because I think he broke the hearts of generals, he broke the hearts of businessmen, he broke the hearts of journalists, he broke the hearts of some political activists and the Kurds as well. So he needs to mend this broken hearts, and he recognized that. And I think this is a good start. The second thing is, he said he's going to rewrite the constitution, and he recognized that he won't be able to do it alone, in consultation with opposition parties, and also with whoever has something to say, so broadening his constituency to get involved in constitution writing. And he also appealed from his rostrum to the people of Gaza, West Bank, and Gaza Strip. This was a message also, quite unveiled message to Israel, I guess. Last but not least, he stated that all these mega projects he promised during the election campaign, the crazy Grand Canal running parallel to the Bosphorus waterways, high-speed trains, not only within Turkey, but also linking Turkey to Middle East, Caucasus, Russia, and Europe, and also these energy networks, Southern Energy Corridor, and also linked with Russia and Iraq. And he said he will start working on these projects immediately on Monday. And the issue of constitution writing is difficult to delay. Yes, he didn't get the overwhelming majority needed to take it to referendum. He's short of four MPs. It is urgent because also the PKK leaders threatened that unless some progress is made on the Kurdish issue, he might start instructing his guerrillas to start attacks or whatever they can do. So he threatened. The deadline he gave was either 15 June or 15 August, alternatively. So there is some urgency. Also, if you look at the composition of the Kurdish MPs who enter the parliament, it shows that it's going to be quite a colorful and assertive parliament, which will make life quite difficult for the ruling party. It's not going to be a matter of arithmetic, how many MPs you have, but how powerful and how empowered the issues are. And economically, yes, I agree, there are some difficulties which the next government has to handle quite quickly. I think they are less important than what we see, of course, in Eurozone countries as well as in China. It requires some sort of correction, and especially in terms of current account deficit, because it's about 10.5% of current GDP. And I want to say a couple of words on EU, if I may, membership. If you look at the election campaign speeches, there was hardly any mention of EU accession, neither in the statements by Erdogan nor in the CHP leader statements. And also in their party programs, about 164 pages, only half a page. But just before the election, as Emma said, Prime Minister announced that he was going to set up a new ministry for EU affairs. It shows determination. It needs to be also, the support for EU needs to be revitalized, not only EU side, but on the Turkish public side. Because I think more or less Turkish public lost its interest in EU accession process because of what it considers to be unfair and unfounded treatment by certain member countries of EU. Plus, in today's circumstances, many will challenge that Turkey will not gain much from EU membership, given that, you know, EU is in a difficult economic situation. Also, in foreign security policy issues, Turkey shouldn't be getting into a straitjacket while it's following its own regional foreign policy. And so even the concessions that Turkey has been asked to give on Cyprus issue, opening its ports to Greek Cypriot ships and airplanes, I think this issue will continue because Turkey opened only 13 of the 35 chapters, policy chapters that candidate countries are required to negotiate. So it's going to be a very hard negotiation, although Erdogan doesn't need to use its nationalistic cards and instincts now. The elections are over. And he will be still very careful on this issue. On the Armenian issue, normalization of relations with Armenia, I think there are good prospects because There have been some serious negotiations between Baku and Erevan recently. They seem to be close. Unless there is a deal done between Azeris and Armenians, it will be quite difficult for Turkey to unilaterally open the border and normalize relations. And I think I better stop here, because I'm sure there will be a lot of questions to discuss this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, and I rather like the idea of a modern version of the Berlin to Baghdad railway, connected with the Hejaz railway all the way down into to Mecca. Now, our final speaker is Hussein Gunn. Hussein began life studying genetics and then became a banker with Merrill Lynch and Crédit Agricole and as a commodity trader, and he's now Managing Director of the Avicenna Capital Group, which is a finance vehicle for direct investment in a range of strategic areas. He's a member of the IISS and former chairman of the advisory board of the Global Fairness Initiative in Washington, D.C., which was under the broad aegis of the former president, Bill Clinton. Hussein, thank you very much indeed. I should just say that Hussein has got it there, that Hussein has written a pamphlet for, and I apologise for not having mentioned this before, creating a Middle Eastern Economic Community, Hussein, and this is under our banner. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Well, I just want to take, I don't want to take anything away from the distinguished guests that I'm sharing this panel with, but I want to take you on something completely different, fresh thinking. Middle East, as we all know, is going through some traumatic phase. Some of us call it evolution, some of us call it revolution. Anti-Western, pro-Western. I'm not a politician. I'm not a diplomat. I'm a humble financier in the region, and the things that I'm seeing are the things which is a requirement. You cannot expect a hungry man or woman to appreciate the real value of freedom on an empty stomach. So there is a great danger that we all face, and we can't kid each other whether the danger exists or not, that the current Arab awakening faces a great risk in being stillborn if new thinking and new direction isn't, or including new resources, isn't infused into the system right away. Just by taking a look and stripping away the whole complexities and just looking at it in a very simplistic format, Middle East today has a youth bulge. It's a phenomenon. A third of its population is about 150 million, is aged between 10 and 24. Youth unemployment at the moment is at 23%, and a further 27% is economically inactive. And the intra-trade, when you look at the Middle East as a whole, as a businessman, the intra-regional trade in the Middle East is about 15% compared to 75% in Europe. So, instead of rediscovering America, I propose just a fresh thinking for the diplomats as well as the politicians to actually think. Creating a Middle East economic community based on two working models. We have WTO since the mid-90s, and it's working quite well. In the MENA region, including Turkey, 11 countries are already members, 7 are observers. We know through Pascal Lamy that it's one of his top priorities to make the 7 observing countries a full member. We also know what Europe was back in 1945, you know, with the public angry, economy in the dumps, What happened? Along came a great US statesman in the form of George Marshall. Marshall Plan was implemented with one very simplistic modus operandi. You need to cooperate together. And conditions were set in motion. Who leapt? Britain. Why? Because Britain had a trade surplus with continental Europe, as does Turkey today with her regional partners. So the similarity between where Europe was back in 1945 and where Middle East is today is very, very similar. Therefore, in order to eradicate and de-risk the current situation, it is also worthy for our friends and partners in the West to think about the idea of supporting the regional economic powerhouse, which is Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, because they are the two G20 members, to establish, by following the rules and regulations stipulated by WTO, whereby a package, a program of economic aid, is provided on a scale of the Marshall Plan, with Turkey in the lead role, because she has the most dynamic and industrialized economy in the region. Now, when you look at the trade levels of Turkey and Europe and Turkey and Middle East, over the last 5 years, the trade has decreased from 50% to 43% between Turkey and EU, and has increased, somewhat rocketed, from single digits to 25% today with the MENA region. And this is simply economic rule 101, export diversity, which the Middle East doesn't have, which Turkey is now doing. Turkey has done that over the last 10 years. She has faced her taboos. She has faced her internal dilemmas. Of course, there is a long way to go, but I do believe that the country has come a long way from where it was half a decade or a decade ago. Therefore, I will conclude by saying that there are just five very simple steps. One, Turkey needs to sign a free trade agreement with Saudi Arabia, which she still doesn't have, which I think is a necessity. Follow the WTO rules, whereby, because WTO has the necessary infrastructure to provide governance as well as provide the necessary infrastructure. Three, Turkey also needs to, with WTO, to expand into the region with the infusion and help of Saudi Arabia. It also, WTO also needs to use the current chaotic environment in the MENA region to energize and bring the observing member Arab countries in the region to become a full member. And also, Turkey always had and will have relations, sometimes rocky, sometimes not, with Israel. Turkey and Israel needs to restore their historic relations. Because in my opinion, I believe that the restoration of this relationship will catalyze the social and economic process in the region even further. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all. It now gives me a very great pleasure to ask Ünal Çevikos, who is the ambassador of the Turkish Republic to the Court of St. James, to try and conclude this very good session. Ünal, thank you very much.
Jack, thank you very much, particularly the part that you said, try and conclude. I will try. Well, it is both easy and difficult to be the last speaker It's difficult because I have a very limited time to wrap up all the previous speakers and perhaps also to try to give an answer to some of the questions. But it's easy in the sense that I'm the last speaker and no one would dare to challenge an ambassador. On Sunday night, I thought that had I been a columnist, I would probably write an article on Monday in a newspaper making a similarity between Prime Minister Erdogan and architect Sinan. You know that architect Sinan has three terms. First term is called the apprenticeship. The second is expertly, his expertise. And the third term is being the master. Now it seems that AKP has won the elections for the third time, and Prime Minister Erdogan probably in the first term was an apprentice, in the second term was an expert, and now in the third term he will be the master. When I read today in the morning that one of the columnists in newspaper Zaman used this similarity, I am convinced that I can become a good columnist. If this is the case, and if Prime Minister Erdogan and the AKP in the third term are going to be the masters, what is the masterpiece then? Because when we think in terms of architect Sinan, his masterpiece is the Mosque of Selimiye in Edirne. What could be the masterpiece of the AKP or the Prime Minister Erdogan? If we look at the balcony speech, I think the main priority that Prime Minister mentioned is the new constitution. So let us hope that he will have the support, he will have the compromise from all sectors and all segments of the society in Turkey to finalize this new constitution, because it is going to be the masterpiece of the AKP government in its third term, and it is going to be the masterpiece of Prime Minister Erdogan. Is it easy? No, it is not, because there are several confrontational issues which the new AKP government and the new parliament are going to face. First of all, the Peace and Democracy Party has increased its members in the parliament. But let me just make a few comments about the results of the elections here and a few numbers. It is true that David Logan has mentioned that a majority of the Turkish population is conservative. And when you look at the history of Turkish democracy, there has been always a tendency of voting about 60 to 65% in the right of the center and 30 to 35% in the left of the center. These election results show exactly this, because there are two right of the center parties whose sum is 63%, and the other two parties finally added up to 100%. Now, when you think in terms of the Peace and Democracy Party, I think it would be quite reductionist to identify this party as a mainly Kurdish party, because there are also some former communists in that party, there are some liberal democrats, and there are also some social democrats who have been elected as the members of parliament, because they have been elected as independent candidates, and when the parliament opens, they will become members of that party. But in general, I believe that the Peace and Democracy Party is a party which could be put in the spectrum to the left of the center. Then there is the Republican People's Party. So in sum, I think there is about a 30 to 35% of the votes in the left of the center. Now, these elections and the electoral system has proved its maturity in a sense that about 96% of the votes went to the four parties who are going to be in the parliament. That means all the other parties have been disintegrated and marginalized, and they have only been able to receive about 5% of the votes. Remember, these are 12 political parties. Four parties received 96% of the votes, 12 parties received 4% of the vote. That is a very significant development, and in spite of the fact that there is a very high threshold, about 10%, I think the electoral system has its own checks and balances and its own rationality, and it has appeared in the parliament as a result of these elections. Now, of course, the priority is going to be the constitution, but there are also several issues as far as foreign policy is concerned. I think, again, David Logan underlined a very important fact. The fact that the EU issues are now going to be tackled by a ministry is simply a commitment of the new government that the EU-Turkish relationship is going to be taken seriously in this third term of the AKP government. Maybe I should simply refer to the project which has been introduced by Hüseyin Gün. We are talking about the Arab Spring, and there is a tendency to make some similarities or parallelisms between the Arab Spring and the revival of the Central and East European countries after the disintegration of the former Soviet Union in 1991. I would like to remind you that after the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991, Turkey came forward with the idea of this Black Sea economic cooperation. If there is that kind of a similarity between the dissolution of the Soviet bloc and the Arab Spring, I think it is exactly the right moment to come up with an idea of a Middle Eastern economic community. Now, I have to underline, however, that the Middle Eastern economic community would never be an alternative for Turkish membership in the European Union. The Black Sea Economic Cooperation has not been an alternative for Turkey, but it is the right moment, it is the right moment for Turkey to introduce a regional scheme which would simply complement the European Union. And I think the Middle Eastern economic community is a very good idea on that respect. Now, is this happening? It is happening because about 2 years ago, Turkey came forward with this idea of the Middle Eastern economic community, and it has been circulated to all the countries in the Middle East, and we have been receiving some positive remarks. But further to that, last year, Turkey has already signed free trade agreements with three of the neighbors, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. So there is already a background for a quadrilateral free trade area in the region, and Turkey is simply counting on building on that existing scheme. Now, the conclusion that the European Union has to draw from this is simply that kind of an initiative and that project would also help the European Union to expand its influence in a very important geography, which is immediately neighboring to Europe. Thank you.